following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
He sat across the desk from me and told me this story. Intelligence said that a fugitive was hiding in the building. This man was known to be dangerous and armed, and he had already demonstrated he had no qualms whatsoever about opening fire on law enforcement. Police were converging on the building, and the officer who was telling me this story talked about how he made his way up the stairwell towards the floor where this fugitive was believed to be hiding. And as he turned the corner, he found himself staring down the barrel of the largest revolver he'd ever seen. Now, all this happened in a split second, but he said it seemed like time just slowed down. He saw the muscles in the man's hand tightening. He saw that hammer begin to drop. And then the gun jammed. Now, the short story is the fugitive was apprehended, taken into custody. Nobody was hurt. But the question I got as we were talking about this in the aftermath was not really the question I'd expected. A lot of us have been asking questions about why am I still here? What plan does God have for me? Things like that. No, that's not what this officer asked me. He looked me in the eye and said, if I had had to fire my weapon that day, would God have forgiven me? We entrust those who wear the badge with an awesome power. The power to execute violence in the name of peace. The power of life and death. And when you think about it, that is a solemn power that ultimately belongs in the hands of God. And we're asking fallible human beings to wield that power. Now, people of good conscience can disagree on the extent to which that power can be delegated to imperfect human beings, the boundaries within which that power should be exercised. That's not why we're here today. Some people in our day have begun to question whether or not we should delegate that power. Why do we give that power to certain people and not to others? And I've actually heard people say, why is it okay for the police to use force on us, but not for us to use force back? As we've seen in our day, there are some places where they're trying to actually strip law enforcement of the use of that power, to place limits that prevent them from doing so. And, in reality, in this fallen, chaotic world that we live in, would not the job of policing be nearly impossible if officers did not have access to that power, if that was not on the table? This conundrum is one of the reasons down through the ages, while some Christian groups have actually forbidden their members from serving in the police or in the military. The way I see it is a little bit different. The way I see it, if that power is so awesome and so solemn and so weighty, would we not prefer to see it exercised by people who feel some sense of accountability to God? Thankfully, we're given some guidance on this in the scriptures. Around 56 AD, the Apostle Paul, probably the first great Christian missionary, one of the first great Christian thinkers, wrote a letter to the Christian community that had formed in Rome, in the center of the empire. Now, most of this letter focuses on heavy theological topics. Paul's detailed explanation of exactly what the gospel is, and in Paul's great summary there in Romans 1, 16 and 17, the gospel is the power of God unto salvation for all who believe in Jesus Christ. But when you get to the end of the letter, Paul takes that gospel and he applies it to some practical situations to show us not just what the gospel is, but this is what the gospel does. This is the difference the gospel makes in our daily lives. And one of the areas in which he does that has to do with our relationship to the state. What does it mean to be a citizen and a follower of Jesus? I want to turn your attention to those verses right now in Romans 13, verses 1 through 7. Paul writes this, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those who exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation unto themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what's good, and you'll have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it's necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now, real briefly this morning, there's a lot in this passage we can look at, but there's five particular principles that I want to point out to you that apply to this question. How do we live as citizens and followers of Jesus at the same time? And the first is this. In this passage, we see that the concept of government itself is a gift from God. As followers of Jesus, we're not excused from showing respect to the government. Paul says every person is to be subject. Now, note carefully, Paul says here, subject and not obey. There's a reason for that. In the New Testament, that word that's translated subject is often used to describe a willing yieldedness to properly constituted authority. It's not just a blind obedience, okay? And hold on to that. That comes important in a minute. But it's not a blind obedience. It is a choice to yield to someone who's in a certain position of authority. And this concept of government authority ultimately derives from God himself. He says there's no authority except from God. That doesn't mean that every specific government is sanctioned by God. It does mean that the concept of government is grounded in God's own character. When we're first introduced to God in Genesis chapter 1, what's God doing? You know, we're described how God brings this world into creation, but in its primordial form, it's just described as darkness and shifting waves covered by water. And the ancient Hebrew thought, the idea of the ocean, the idea of water was of something that's constantly in motion and churning and all the waves, and it's unstable and it's chaotic. And so the Spirit of God is depicted hovering over this chaotic mess of a world, and then he begins to speak. And what is he doing? He is imposing order on the chaos. And all through the Bible, that's what we see God doing, imposing order on chaos. We get to 1 Corinthians 14, and Paul is describing how Christians should conduct their worship in an orderly fashion. And what's the reason he gives? According to 1 Corinthians 14:33, because God is not a God of confusion, but of peace. Another word to translate that word that's used for peace there is a God of order. God is constantly imposing order on chaos. We get to Revelation, and the new heaven and the new earth are described when God recreates creation to create this ideal state that he intended before we messed it up. And it's described as there is no sea. Now, that's not because God's against going to the beach. That's because, again, that idea that the sea represents chaos. And in God's new creation, there is no chaos. There's order. Perfect order. The Bible teaches that ultimately God superintends all governments, even those that do not recognize him. Psalm 47, verse 7, we read, "For God is the king of all the earth. Sing praises with a psalm of wisdom. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne." Even those nations that don't recognize him, God is still in control of history. He is still moving things the way he wants to move them, and ultimately, even those nations are accountable to him. Paul says this in Acts 17, that he's speaking to those Greek philosophers in Athens, and he says, "He himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation." God's in control. God raises nations up. God lets nations fall. And he oversees all of that. That means that those who resist properly constituted government authority are actually opposing a principle that God himself has established. You may say, but wait a minute. What if the government's not very godly? Well, remember the context in which Paul wrote these words. Paul's not sitting there in the United States of America today with a constitution that protects individual liberty. He's writing to, or in the context of, the Roman Empire. AD 56, still a few years away from any official government-sanctioned persecution against Christians. But already the Roman government was far from godly. While Rome was a nation that valued law and order, it was particularly brutal in some of the ways it enforced that order. already in Paul's lifetime, about 10 years before he wrote this letter, the for the most part, benevolent emperor named Claudius had already briefly expelled all the Jews and by extension, most of the Christians from the city of Rome because of some disputes that were going on. Historians look back at that and they say, well, the disputes were between the Jews and Christians over who Jesus was. And so Claudius finally said, hey, you guys are causing too much trouble. Get out of here. And it was a few years before he allowed him to come back in. But when Paul wrote this, the emperor was not Claudius. It was Nero, one of the most corrupt and violent men to ever occupy the throne of Rome. Now, there's a time and a manner to resist government, especially when it's becoming ungodly. But a believer's basic stance should be of respectful compliance, to be good citizens, no matter what state we find ourselves in. Now, when God establishes government, he has given government some basic responsibilities, and Paul describes those here in verses 3 and 4. It basically boils down to two things, okay? The basic responsibilities of government are, one, to preserve order, and two, to protect the vulnerable. That's the most basic expression of government. Government as a concept may be God-ordained, but specific forms of government are human-operated. That means that the God-given authority is always in the hands of imperfect people. And imperfect people are sometimes prone to do some really ungodly things. While some forms of government may be better at tempering this ungodly impulse we have than others, to be honest, there's no human government that's exempt from it. So as long as you got people in the mix, you're not going to have a perfect government. But the only alternative to government, no matter how imperfect, is no government or anarchy. I have to be honest, I have a bit of a libertarian streak in me. But even I will tell you, no government typically is worse than even an imperfect government. Because we see this principle described in the Bible, in the history of the people of Israel. In that period between when they entered the Promised Land and the establishment of the first Jewish monarchy under King Saul. It's a period covered by a book we call Judges in the Old Testament. And what we see, there's a phrase that comes up at least three times in that book. And it goes like this. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And what usually follows those words is a description of moral chaos and depravity. When we are unrestrained, when we're not accountable to anybody, we have a tendency to go off the rails. Therefore, it's reasonable to conclude that some form of government is necessary for human flourishing. And some form is preferable to no government. Now, in verses 3 and 4, again, Paul describes what the government's supposed to be doing. He describes government officials in three ways. In verse 3, he talks about rulers. Now, long story short, this is a reference to what the Romans called magistrates. In the Roman system, magistrates were the officials who oversaw law enforcement in any given Roman city. They oversaw the court system. Paul's definitely talking about government officials here. He also mentions in verse 3, people with authority. And the Greek word there is a word called exousia, same where we get our word executive from. And I don't tell you that because I'm trying to impress you, because I'm not the best Greek student in the world. But when you translate a document written in one language into another language, sometimes there's little nuances of meaning that get lost in translation that really bring the text alive. So that's why I'm trying to point this out to you. This word literally means those who have the power of choice, or the liberty to do as one pleases. In the Roman system, government officials typically not only had the authority to do what they pleased, but also to compel other people to do what they pleased. Although the scopes of that were limited in some ways, but still, they had a lot of power, a lot of authority. And then he calls them ministers of God. And that, interesting enough, that word there, minister, is the same word we get our word deacon from in Greek. It means one who makes haste to carry out the commands of one's master. Now, a lot of Roman officials would have been very familiar with the concept of delegated authority. No one wants place in the pecking order, okay? But note that this government made up of magistrates who exercise such authority, Paul calls these people servants of, not Rome, servants of God. What we're seeing described here is a structure that imposed order on an otherwise chaotic society. Those that respect that structure have nothing to fear from it, okay? If you're driving down the road and you see a police car slide in behind you, how many of your pulse starts to speed up a little bit? Well, if you're driving under the speed limit, you got nothing to worry about, do you? Not rocket science. Government preserves order. Government also, one of the ways government preserves order is by protecting the vulnerable. Paul says those who practice evil should be afraid of the government. If you're crossing the line, if you're violating the order, that's when you need to be afraid. Now, whereas Paul says in verse 3, the government is a servant of God for the benefit of those who do good, in verse 4, he says, government is a servant of God that brings wrath on those who practice evil. Good government protects the innocent. Also in verse 4, Paul says the government serves God's purpose by being an avenger on those who do evil. Who's being avenged? Well, in a sense, all vengeance belongs to God. Did the Bible say that? Ultimately, because he's the one that's wronged by our sin. However, our sin, as terrible as it might be, it didn't really hurt God. Okay? God's not hurt by our sin. So there's nothing there for human government to avenge. It's not like God's going to take you into the court and file a civil suit against you. Our sin may not hurt God, though, but unfortunately, sometimes it has a tendency to hurt other people. Our sin sometimes spills over and makes collateral damage in the lives of others. Jimmy shared some of that in his testimony. Now, we know from the Old Testament that God makes a big priority of standing up for the victim, of standing up for the disadvantaged, of standing up for the innocent. We see it in the Ten Commandments. We see it in the Law of Moses. We see it all through the Old Testament prophets. And a properly structured government should stand up for the victim, should stand up for the disadvantaged, should stand up for the innocent. It protects those who are vulnerable. How does it do that? Well, to carry out these basic responsibilities, the government has a legitimate authority to use force. Why should evildoers be afraid of the government? Because Paul says in verse 4, because the government does not bear the sword for nothing. What Paul is saying here is that the government is justified in using force to carry out its God-given purpose of preserving order and protecting the vulnerable. And sometimes the only way to stop someone who is intent on pursuing violence, unfortunately, is to employ violence against them. In addition, we also demonstrate the value we place on something by the sanction we place on violating it. That's why when human society was getting its second chance after the great flood, God told Noah, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. If human beings really are made in God's image and the human life really is precious, and somebody who takes that life has violated something extremely precious and they have forfeited their own life as a result. Under the law of Moses, there were certain crimes, capital crimes like murder, rape, or rebellion against the community that were punishable by execution. But you know how they carried that out? It's really interesting. They didn't have designated executioners. The entire community would come together to execute the offender, usually by stoning. Here's why that's important. That meant that everybody in the community had a role in carrying out justice. It was a personal involvement there. They saw the price for violating those norms. And they participated as a community, not as individuals, but as a community in ensuring that justice was done. That's something, by and large, we've lost in our world. There is an irreconcilable gap between violence that's carried out merely for personal satisfaction and violence committed by the state with the goal of preserving order, punishing injustice, and protecting the innocent. They don't even compare. One is the community coming together to carry out the functions of government, and the other is just personal vendettas. But that doesn't mean governments can do whatever they want to. Because any government that exceeds or abuses its authority ultimately is answerable to God. To quote the Amazing Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. Newsflash for you, Peter Parker's uncle didn't come up with that. In fact, it was Jesus who said in Luke 12:48, for to the one whom much is given, much will be required. In the Old Testament, we see God actually holding accountable even nations that he had used for his purposes. We've talked a lot recently about how, you know, God made this covenant with the people of Israel there at Mount Sinai. And when they made that covenant, God said, I'm going to let you live in this land of promise as long as you keep your part of the covenant. But if you violate the covenant, I'm going to send a foreign nation to come in and to remove you from this promised land. And what happened in their history? Well, despite repeated warnings from God's prophets, his people fell into this unrepentant pattern of idolatry, immorality, and injustice. And so in the end, what happened? God kept his word. In the 8th century BC, God allowed the Assyrian Empire to invade and conquer the northern half of Israel and carry off a large portion of those residents into exile. scattered throughout the Mediterranean. And then about 130 years later, in the 6th century, God allowed the Babylonian Empire to invade the southern part of Israel, to destroy Jerusalem, and to carry off a large portion of its residents into exile. God allowed that in both cases. But even though God used both of these nations as tools of judgment, their brutality in doing so exceeded what he had intended. And those of you who are joining us on Wednesday nights for our Bible study we got going on right now in the book of Zechariah, you've already heard this. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. In Zechariah 1, verses 12 through 15, Zechariah is getting this vision where he's talking to an angel. The angel of the Lord said, "Lord of armies, how long will you take no pity on Jerusalem and the cities of Judah with which you have been indignant for these 70 years? And the Lord responded to the angel who was speaking with me with gracious words, comforting words. So the angel who was speaking with me said to me, proclaim, saying, this is what the Lord of armies says. Listen to this. I am exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem and Zion, but I am very angry with the nations who are carefree. For while I was only a little angry, they furthered the disaster." Those nations who are carefree, he's talking about there, Assyria and Babylon. Because they exceeded the mandate he had given them. He intended to use them to discipline his people, but instead they came in brutally, murdering men, women, even dashing babies' heads against the walls. Just brutal treatment of the people. And God, as a result, judged those whom he had used in judgment. And the capitals of both of those empires are now piles of rock and uninhabited. God wiped them out of history. In the New Testament, we have the example of city guards who received instruction from John the Baptist. John the Baptist, of course, was the prophet who preceded Jesus. And John was preaching to these large crowds who came out to hear him, and he was proclaiming to people their need to repent of their sins and get right with God. And Luke records something that happened when members of the local police force came to John and said, "Well, what about us? What does this mean for us?" And in Luke 3:14, the soldiers who were questioning him saying, "What are we to do as well? And he said to them, "Do not extort money from anyone, nor harass anyone, but be content with your wages." So in essence, John was telling these officers, don't abuse your authority. He didn't condemn them for being officers, because we need people in that role to preserve order and protect the vulnerable. But he said, don't abuse your authority. And he also said, don't seek to enrich yourself through your office. Be content with your wages. When government is acting within its proper sphere of authority, it has a right to expect support and respect from its citizens. As long as the government's abiding by its legitimate functions, we as believers have a responsibility to act as good citizens. So what happens when a government exceeds those boundaries? What happens when a government begins to act in brutal and unjust ways? What happens when a government begins to try to take over some of the rights and privileges that belong to God himself, begins to demand worship from his people that should belong only to God? What is our responsibility then? Because that's what happened in Rome. They started to call on people to bow down and worship the emperor as a god. And Christians said, we can't do that. So what are we to do? Well, I'm going to give you the answer. Some of you may not like it. When the government starts to act in God's place and starts to call on us to compromise our commitment to God, our solution is not to take up arms. It is to take up our cross. And that's what we see in the New Testament. That's what we see in the history of the church. That's what we see in the book of Revelation. We see people who stood up to ungodly governments and said, you may break my body, but you cannot break my soul, because that's hidden in Jesus. And I will not bow the knee to Caesar. I will not throw away my commitment to Jesus. You can do whatever you want to me. You can throw me to the lions. You can nail me to a cross. You can do like Nero did and tie people up and use them as human torches. But I am not going to violate my faith in my Savior. We have to be willing to overcome by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony. Every single one of us has a date on the docket with the heavenly judge. Every single one of us will give an account of the way we have conducted ourselves and how we have handled the stewardship that he's entrusted to us. And this is one trial no one can talk themselves out of. And there's no getting off on a technicality. This judge not only sees clearly what we've done, he sees through to the motivations of our hearts. If this judge entrusts the power of life and death to a human government, what kind of power should we expect him to wield when we're standing before him directly? When that time comes, do you want to stand before this great and holy God all by yourself, or with an advocate who can stand there to plead your case. Because that's what the gospel is all about. In 1 John 2, verses 1 and 2, John writes, "My little children, I am writing these things so that you may not sin. But if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And He Himself is the propitiation or the payment for our sins. And not for ours only, but for the sins of the whole world." Jesus wants to be your defense attorney. Most of us will never know when our summons will come due. But when we've entrusted ourselves to Jesus, we can rest in assurance that when that time comes, we will not stand before God alone and we will find mercy.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.